This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast. And it's a special, and it's a very strange podcast today. Well, strange is the wrong word. It's just different. We've got Julie Waddle coming on, who's the woman who invented smoked hummus. And very briefly, the story, I'll get her to tell it in a bit more detail, but very briefly, she contacted me and said, maybe we should do something on the podcast, maybe I could sponsor you. And then I started talking to her, and I thought her story was so cool that I thought people would be interested. She basically set this business up, and yeah, she's made a real success of it. I'll let her tell the story when we get on the podcast in a minute. But she also bought in a lot of her products for us to taste. So, Fina, what do you make of the product?
So tasty. So good, tasty.
I'm not just saying that. I don't lie. This stuff is really good. It tastes absolutely immense. Slightly more expensive than normal hummus.
But so worth it.
Yeah, you can tell why, because it does taste great. But apologies. I hadn't had any lunch, so I just keep eating and eating. And a lot of it, I'm crunching carrots through it. So, yeah, apology for that. But let's meet her. This is Julie Waddle. Julie, welcome to my kitchen. Thank you very much for coming down from Devon today, is it? Up from Devon.
Across from Devon.
Across.
Yes.
Okay, like all the guests, I bought you a present. I'm repeating myself now. I've started repeating myself, but a good present is a good present. I go by the four Bs: books, booze, bouquet, or balls. I didn't get you a ball or a bouquet. Or booze. Or I got you a book, Tools of Titans. Have you read this book?
I have not read this book.
It's a good book. Tim Ferriss, he interviews... or has interviewed in his time on his podcast and whatever else, loads of people who are industry leaders. And because you're an industry leader, it's because you're great at what you do.
Thank you.
We're going to, you'll enjoy reading that. Okay.
I will.
I've made a big mistake because we've got a lot of your food in front of me and I haven't had lunch.
That's not a mistake. That's perfect.
I don't know, because I think I'll eat too much. Right. Before we get tasting that stuff, let's talk a bit about how we know each other and then a bit about your story. So we know each other. You approached me and you said to me, I'd be interested in sponsoring the podcast. So by the way, that bleep is my cat coming in and out. You said you'd be interested in doing it because you like the podcast. We had a chat. We're not sure about the value of it all and everything else. And then we came up with the idea that because you've got a great story, we'd interview you for the podcast.
Yep, exactly.
So tell us your story then.
So the story is that back in 2012, I still have two children. One of them was a particularly fussy eater. I come from a catering family. I grew up in Northern Ireland. My grandparents were restaurateurs. I'm, you know, used to cooking and making nice food for my own family. But this second child just wouldn't eat any of the good food that I would make for him. So I'd make a lovely organic casserole and he would not eat it. He would say, I want the sausages, I want the pizza. And it was driving me mad. I couldn't seem to hit on something that this child would eat that was actually good for him. So one day I was thinking, well, what healthy thing does he eat that I might be able to do something with? And the one healthy thing he would eat, like a lot of kids, is hummus. And I thought, right, what can I do to make hummus taste amazing? So he likes smoked fish, smoked cheese, that kind of flavor profile. And I thought, I wonder if I smoked some chickpeas and made that into hummus, would that taste nice? Would he eat lots of it? So I found a James Martin recipe, and I've never credited James Martin, so I hope he's not going to send me a bill. Not for smoked chickpeas, but for smoked duck.
Right.
So you can smoke anything in a wok in your kitchen.
Okay.
So you add tea leaves, rice, and sugar to a wok. You cover it very carefully in tin foil, or you'll ruin your wok. And then whatever it is you want to have smoked flavour in, you put that thing on top. So he was doing smoked duck. I changed it for chickpeas. And it worked. The chickpeas came out with a lovely smoky flavour. And then I blended that into a standard hummus recipe and ended up with this sort of smoky tasting hummus. And my son loved it. And I thought, well, that's worked then. That's been successful. Here I am creating something healthy with my sort of culinary creativity skills that this child will actually eat. But then people came to the house and they were trying it and going, oh, wow, that's amazing. And I thought, okay, that, you know, that's really flattering. But at the same time, I used to work on the food programme on Radio 4 and I was doing some research into hummus. And I discovered that hummus is a massive, massive market in this country. It's hugely popular. So it came over in the 1980s-ish. It's about 30 years old in the UK in the mainstream, sort of mainstream retail, where we could all buy hummus. And it's just become such a massively popular product. So back in 2012, when I did this research, I discovered the market was worth £60 million for hummus in the UK.
You thought, I want a bit of that.
Well, you know, who wouldn't? But I'd always been quite entrepreneurial. And so these two things happened kind of simultaneously. I invented this new kind of hummus. And sure enough, when I Googled smoked hummus, it had not been done before. Now it has. Michelin-starred chefs have smoked hummus on their menu. It has become a thing, which I'm very proud of.
So you invented it?
Yeah.
Do you think worldwide, do you think?
There was one in the States that I could find, and that was the only other one in the world.
But do you think people, where does hummus come from originally?
So, obviously, it has sort of the Lebanese, Israeli origins. Some people talk about North African origins, which is kind of the play on words of the name of my products.
Right.
Greek, how Mediterranean.
How do you say it? Hummus. How do you?
You say it whatever way you want. Lots of people say it lots of different ways. Not only that, they spell it in lots of different ways. So when I go on to Twitter to see what, you know, what's the latest chat, what are people saying about smoked hummus, I have to go through all the different spellings to find all the different comments, because there is no one right or wrong way of saying it.
You're saying hummus.
I say hummus. Some people say hummus.
Yeah, I've heard it pronounced so many different ways. Yeah, and I'm never sure. It's one of those words now when it comes up, I'm like, oh, I don't want to say it in case I say it wrong.
There is no wrong.
You're going hummus.
I say hummus.
All right, we'll go with hummus then, because that's what you're saying. You gave me a lot of information there, so let's go back and pick through the bones of it. First of all, children like hummus, do they?
Yes.
Do they?
Yes. Not all kids.
And it's
as soon
one
as you say
things.
that a child likes something, then obviously the next day they stop liking it. It's a really, if you look at, you know, little kids' lunchboxes or picnics, they love hummus.
Yeah.
It's quite bland.
But it's, I think also the idea that you can, quite often you're dunking something. Kids like that.
So there's research, you're right, there's research that shows that dipping, because it's fun, dipping gets kids to try more vegetables, and they actually eat more vegetables that they don't like when they're dipping, because they're so busy having fun dipping that they forget.
I've got a great tip, but I can't make any money out of this. It's I've got three children, so I've gone through this twice, this process, because two of them are twins. If you want your children to eat vegetables, I'm not sure whether I should say this because people might think I'm unhealthy. But for the period where they go, a lot of kids go through that period where they go, I don't want to eat vegetables anymore. If you smother them in butter, they suddenly taste really nice, and the kids love them, especially beans and broccoli and everything. And they start
and they need fat, so that's
then,
okay.
And slowly start taking the butter off, and you're just left with the vegetable. That's how I've done it. If you do use that, it's my idea. So can you send me some money? Thank you very very much. So so you decided to smoke them in your kitchen to begin with. How long was it before you decided that was going to, this could be a commercial product?
So I did the research that showed me there was a huge market. And then just one of those moments where I woke up one day and went, hang on, I've just done some research into a massive market. I've just invented something at home that, you know, although it was a massive market, my research showed it was lacking in innovation. So there's lots of hummus. You can get, you know, plain hummus, skinny hummus, lemon and coriander, red pepper, but that's it. No one had really done anything else with hummus. And I thought, well, actually, it's a massively popular product that's lacking in innovation, and I've just invented smoked hummus, which is completely new. So I knew that worked on paper, but what you don't know is if you give things to people in your home, they're quite likely, hopefully if they like you, to say, oh, that's really nice. But, you know, will people who don't know you actually like it? And would they buy it? So those are two completely different questions to people who are sort of friends and family saying, oh, that's lovely.
Yeah.
So then I took it to my local deli. We lived in Birmingham and had a chat with them about it. And they said, well, why don't you do a blind taste test? We'll let you do it in the deli. So I put out two plain white bowls of hummus, Sainsbury's own label ordinary hummus, and my smoked hummus. And this was just on a little table in the deli as the customers were coming in. And I put out two questionnaires and I stood back. And, you know, obviously I didn't know all these people that were coming into the shop, but they tasted the hummus and they filled out the questionnaire. The most important question was the one I asked at the end, which is, which one do you prefer? Yep. So I asked, you know, is it, which one has the right garlic and salt or blah, blah, blah. But really, it was, which one do you prefer? And the smoked hummus came out 4-1 winner. And I thought, ah, ha, ha, that gives me enough confidence to think that actually people really like it and therefore would hopefully buy it. So I spoke to the deli lady at the end and said, you know, this is, thanks for having me. This is brilliant. Look what it showed. And she said, oh, well, we'll stock it then, because obviously our customers like it. So hopefully they'll buy it. And that was it. We were off.
Were you nervous putting it to a taste test? It's like Pepsi Coke, wasn't it? It's like
yeah, because that would have been make or break. If they'd said, no, that's horrible, then all this would never have happened.
But you did have confidence in people thinking they were going to like it.
Well, I think, you know, I'm not a chef, but I know what tastes nice. And
why do you know that? Because of the working on the food program?
More growing up with a catering family and being around cooking and creativity in the kitchen and just making things taste lovely.
So your family's always been in catering?
So my grandparents were caterers.
Oh, were they?
Yes.
Doing what?
They had a restaurant, which is still there, owned by a distant relative in a wee place in Northern Ireland called Donaghadee. And the restaurant is called Bow Bells. Okay. And it was like the first fast food restaurant, but proper, healthy, home-cooked fast food. My granny was in the kitchen.
So what was the popular dish on there then?
Chicken and ham pie with stuffing.
Oh, that's good. I've not had any lunch.
I'm so hungry.
All right, so from there then to your parents, they did catering as well?
No. I used to work in the restaurant. So now, right. My parents are very quiet, sort of ordinary people who, you know, my dad had a very regular job and was not entrepreneurial at all. So I think it's skipped a generation.
Right.
And I've gone the way my grandparents
did. So what were you doing on the food show, the food programme, sorry, on Radio 4?
So, well, I used to read the news on local BBC radio, but as a foodie person, that was the show that I really loved on Radio 4. So I just thought one day I was on a news shift, it was 11 o'clock at night, I'm like, oh, is this really what I want to do for the rest of my life? What I'd really like is to work on the food programme. And I thought, well, I'll just call down to Broadcasting House and see if there's any way I could maybe do a bit of work experience. And I picked up the phone and rang the number, and there was a voicemail saying, thank you for calling the food programme at Broadcasting House. We've now moved to the mailbox in Birmingham, which is where I was sitting.
Right.
And so it's a massive, massive office. And round the corner was Countryfile and the Hairy Bikers and the food programme. And I'd never realised it had come to the same office that I was sitting in every day. So I popped round the next time I was in on a day shift and met Dan Saladino, who's the presenter of the show.
Right.
And he very kindly agreed to let me come and do some work. I know he gets approached a lot, and it's not something he often does to agree to let someone just start working for him, but he kindly did, and I did.
So I'm very conscious people will be sitting at home going, I'm going to set up a product, but you are a special person because you can tell that you're someone who goes and gets stuff in life. That's one of the qualities you need, isn't it, if you're going to do that?
You've got to have a great product, right?
Yeah.
If the product is not good, people might buy it once. If it's in lovely packaging, they'll never buy it again. If they take it home and go, ooh, you know, that's not what I expected, or it's not very nice.
Very true.
So the product is absolutely key. But you're right, there are certain personal characteristics that help to determine a level of success, I think.
So why is it called Moorish?
That again was just, well, I actually had a different name that I won't reveal because I might use it one day for something else. But I spoke to my husband and said, oh, I'm thinking of calling it this. And he said, no, that's too childish. So I had to think again and just flashed into my head, Moorish, obviously your food is Moorish. You want to eat more of it. And that's a really nice descriptor for food. You go, oh, that's really Moorish. And then I thought, well, how about if I use the different spelling, sort of the North African origins of hummus, and call it Moorish with the double O, that could work really well. And people always comment on the name. They love it.
So it's a spelling From North Africa?
Moorish, as in from the Moors in North Africa.
Oh, right, okay. Are you aware there's a falafel place in Norwich? I was there the other day and they've got Moorish.
There's a restaurant in Ashburton down the road from me called Moorish. Yes, yes.
Can you not get, do you own it? Can you sue them? We've making some more cash.
Tim, you're a natural entrepreneur. We've trademarked the name. You trademark under a certain class. We've trademarked the name Moorish for products of this type.
Okay, so you've bought some product along with you now. How many different products have you got?
So in our key retailer, I don't know, am I allowed to say who that is?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, that's Waitrose. We supply four products currently, and that's the ones you've got here.
How many products do you make? Just four?
So there's another flavour that goes to some of the smaller retailers, farm shops and delis. But this is the core range of products.
Amazing. That we'll talk about how you got into Waitrose. Actually, do it now. How on earth do you get a product into Waitrose? I'm desperate to try some of this, but tell us that first.
Well, you can eat and I can talk. So what happened was that local deli is where it all began. And then I started. So I had to, from the very beginning, it had to be made in a factory because I didn't have the right kitchen set up at home to provide food to go into the sort of commercial environment. I didn't have what environmental health would certify in my home kitchen. You have to have doors between toilets, two doors, I think, and two sinks. Didn't have any of that. So I had to find a factory. But Birmingham is quite a good place if you're looking for any kind of factory. There are quite a few. So I emailed a load of factories. I kind of knew just somehow in my head that I couldn't say too much. I was careful, always very careful about what I revealed, so things weren't copied. But luckily, one factory came back and said, yeah, you can come in and stand in here yourself and make the product. So that's what I did. I bought a big blender.
What? You did it yourself?
Yeah. So I was still working for the food program. And then I would finish my shift there, go to the factory. I had a big blender that I bought off eBay. I'd gone out to the wholesaler and bought sort of all the chickpeas and tahini and all the stuff you need. I'd found a local smokery that smoked bacon in West Bromwich.
Oh, what's that? What happens there then? Have they just got a big room with smoke in it?
Yeah.
And then, but different sorts of smoke, I imagine. Did you have to find a smoke to suit your
chickpeas? I specified that I wanted specific wood chips that give the right flavour, because I'd tried at home. I'd bought a little eco smoker and smoked food in the shed. And my kids always laugh because I did nearly burn down the shed one day when I went out and forgotten that I had things smoking in the shed. But I knew what wood I wanted. I remember driving to Kettering one day and going and buying a massive carload of these wood chips, taking them to the smokery man in West Bromwich. I would give him big tins of chickpeas. He would smoke the chickpeas. Then he'd drive over to the factory where I was making the hummus, drop off the sort of the special ingredient, these smoked chickpeas. I'd have everything else. Mix it all up in the factory, put it into little pots. I'd printed off little labels at home, put it in a cool box in the car and drive it out to the deli and sell it.
So how long do you have to smoke a chickpea for?
Oh, that's a trade secret.
Oh, okay.
Tim.
Right, yeah, that's true. Don't tell me stuff that would be.
Yeah, it depends. It depends.
So I'm going to try some now. I've got so many questions. So I'm gonna, is this the one?
Well, no, if you're going to.
What's the original one?
That.
Okay.
The original, just.
Oh,
plain.
The one I was going to try was with chili. That
you were going for the
very exciting
for the big hitter flavour wise. So if you start with this,
I'm using a carrot here. So hold on, got to get in it. Tell us. Actually, no. Wait till I. Wait till I try it first.
Okay.
Okay, Fina, are you going to try some as well?
Yes, I am.
Oh, that's delicious.
Well, I didn't pay you to say that, but I'm very, very glad you like it.
That's so good.
Oh my gosh, it's so good.
Oh, thank you. This is what makes me happy. That's what it's all about.
That good. Works really well, doesn't it?
Thank you.
I suppose it's because the. Right. I'm going to try your one with the chili.
You can move up a level in flavour.
I'm using carrots, if you can hear the crunchiness. Okay, this is the one with chili.
I'm glad you hadn't had a massive lunch before I arrived.
Yeah.
That's really good as well.
So that's just like
a
different.
It's got a nice little warmth to it.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting. Everybody has their own chili barometer. Some people will say, oh, that's so spicy. And other people will say, I can't get any spice.
Oh, it's not too spicy. It's a nice warmth.
That's.
I do a lot of tasting every Sunday. This is really good. Now what am I doing now?
Thank you.
Baba ganoush. Right, I love this stuff.
So. I'd go with the bread for that one. Because it carries the flavour. Different again, isn't it?
I'm moving to bread.
Yeah, it's lighter. Mm.
Fina's not on mic, but she's saying it's fresher.
So baba ganoush, obviously, hummus everybody's heard of. Baba ganoush, a lot of people have heard of, but some people haven't. So it's a smoky aubergine dip.
That's really nice as well.
Oh, thank you.
If you're hungry and listening to this podcast, we must do more of these ones where we get to taste stuff.
Yeah.
And what's this final one?
So this is a garlic aioli with Sicilian lemon. So that's a relatively new addition to the family.
And what is it? What is
it's aioli? You could think of it like a posh garlic mayonnaise.
Yeah.
It goes really well with tapas or seafood, barbecue, that kind of thing. Or with a salad.
That's really nice as well.
Yay! You like them all. That's good.
And what are the little pots you've got here?
So these are what we call snack packs. So shall I?
Yeah.
I'll pass you one over. We go that way. So this is my first sort of proper job, not working in my grandparents' restaurant, was at British Airways. When I'd finished university, I started working in head office at BA. And I got to know a lot about business and corporate life and how things are done. And when I invented the product, I thought, I know where this would work really well. British Airways, because
yes.
You know, it's a really nice product. You actually lose quite a large percentage of your taste buds capability when you're in the air, so they need products that have a really sort of a really uplifting flavor. It's got to be,
you do what, you lose what,
the capability of your taste buds. You can taste less well in the air.
Why?
It's a biological fact. I don't know the medical sort of reason, but you do. You
is
can't
that why
taste
the only time anyone eats
tomato juice.
Tomato. I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
It's because you're suddenly on a plane. You go, I'll have
right.
a tomato juice.
Yeah.
I think it's more there's a bottle of tomato juice there or a carton. And you think, yeah, I'll have that. Go
no,
on.
No, it's a thing.
So
it
no,
is a
it's
thing.
Good. Right.
So I spoke to British Airways. I didn't know anyone there because it was sort of the late 90s when I worked there originally. But I called them up and said, look, I used to work in the business. I'm not just a random person. But I have now invented a food product that I think you'd like. And they very kindly invited me in. And they said, well, we can't have it in these sort of the pots that you get it in Waitrose. But if you could do a little version with breadsticks, and they put it in club kitchen. So there's a fridge. If you get hungry in between the meal service, you can go and help yourself from this little fridge in business class. And in there, you will find these hummus and breadstick snack packs. So once they said there was an opportunity, then my immediate drive is to go away and make it happen. So then I find a way to make these snack packs.
What happens in these meetings when you do that? Is it like Dragon's Den?
It can be. It very much depends on the personality. Retail buyers are quite scary because they hold a lot of power. You know, a retail buyer giving you a listing, as it's called, saying they'll take your product, has huge... huge life-changing implications. So the lady that, I guess we can talk about how I got into Waitrose, but the lady that gave me my first listing in Waitrose, I'm still friends with her because she really did change my life and she knows that. So it's quite a daunting meeting.
She keep turning up her door. I love you. You changed my life. She's going, leave me alone now. You're fine.
All right, Jay.
go on. So how did she do it then?
So what happened was, so I was selling in this deli in Birmingham. And I went to some other delis then, because the first time I delivered in the product, I was thinking, you know, fingers crossed, will anybody buy it? And if they buy it, will they ever come back and buy it again? Or is it one of these one-off things out of curiosity? But they did buy it, and they came into the deli again and told the lady, oh, that hummus was really nice, you know, I'll buy it again. And they started to repeat purchase, and people started to tweet, bought this amazing hummus. And I was going, oh, this is exciting, this is good. And I kind of knew I'd had some ideas for businesses before, all sorts of random stuff, and I'd never really gone anywhere. As soon as I had the idea for this, right back at the very beginning of thinking this could be a business, I kind of knew it was something really exciting. I just had that feeling this could be really quite big and quite exciting. So then to see that playing out in this deli was like, great, yep, you know, this is what I was hoping might happen. So then I went to some other delis and said, this product's selling really well in this deli, would you like it? Well, yes, if it's selling well, they do. So eventually I got to capacity where I couldn't make enough in the factory myself. And by this stage, we'd got into Planet Organic in London and then Whole Foods in London. So it had branched out beyond just my home city of Birmingham to becoming more of a national thing. And I thought, well, actually, you know how much you pay for a pot of hummus? It's not much, even for a posh hummus like mine. It's still less than £2. And if you think about the profit margin, not that much of that £2 comes to me. So I thought, well, if I'm going to make this into a business, I'm going to have to sell a lot of hummus. You have to sell a lot of pots to make any kind of reasonable income. And my husband was retraining as an osteopath. He'd been in the army and come out. And so he needed me to be the breadwinner. And I thought, well, this could be the way to win the bread, but I have to sell a lot of hummus. So who do you go to if you've got a premium product that you need decent volume? Well, the answer is Waitrose. So I sent them an email, again, very conscious that I knew I couldn't say too much.
Can I just stop you? We'll go back to that. But you've got yourself into Whole Foods and Planet Organic. Mm. I don't know if they're all around the country, but they're a real big deal in London.
London, yeah.
I mean, everyone wants a Whole Foods and a Planet Organic because we're all poncy down here and we want doing our yoga or whatever it's supposed to be doing. But they are a huge deal. And that must have been a big deal for you to get in there.
That was massive. That was massive. So I remember the Planet Organic thing. So I had a mentor who was helping me. She was the global CEO of Gantt, nothing to do with hummus whatsoever. I'd found her in a magazine, looked her up on LinkedIn. She'd said she was looking to mentor a young businesswoman. And my husband kindly told me I wasn't that young, but I could give it a go. And she immediately wrote back to my message on LinkedIn and said, you know, I'm in a different sector, but business is business. Let's meet up and see if I can help. And she was amazing. And she knew the man, one of the owners of Planet Organic. And this is where it starts to be. You know, network is very, very helpful. So I didn't know him, could never have approached him.
Yeah, but if you've got the product, they need you as much as you need them, right?
Yes, but it's finding that way to be them. Heard above the noise. Cause, you know.
So when I go to Planet Organic or Whole Foods, I always think everything I'm buying there is going to be on the healthy side of things. You know? So is your product healthy?
So we're not in Planet Organic because we were, and then they changed so their hummus range became only organic, and that's not us. But we're still in Whole Foods, and they won't take any products that have any artificial additives, and that is, you know, that's part of the criteria to supply them. So they only take products that are definitely what we call clean deck, so they don't have any nasties.
Okay, what are nasties? E-number type things?
Yes, exactly. Preservatives.
So
additives.
How do you do that calculation then? Because obviously the longer it can stay on the shelves, the more you can make, you know, because this stuff when it goes, what's the longevity of it? How long?
By the time you would buy it in the shop, it might have 16 days, maybe less, depending on how quickly it's, you know, selling off the shelf. So you don't have a long time.
So it lasts about, from the moment it's made to the moment it goes off is about 3 weeks, is it, or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so if you add a few E numbers, you can get a couple of months out of it.
That's right. And you will see some of the supermarket own label hummus has a preservative.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, because they do last a long time, some of those ones, don't they?
But do you want to know one of these serendipitous things? Yeah. Smoking the chickpeas, well, you know what smoking does to food.
Yeah,
it cures the food. And that was another one of those things. So when I was still making the product in Birmingham, and we had to have it lab tested as you do to find out the shelf life. And it came back, and the man that rang me from the factory was saying, your results are back and it's lasting a really long time. We don't understand. And it's the smoked chickpeas that are curing the product that give it a naturally longer shelf life.
Lasting how? Without becoming dangerous?
Without going off. Yeah.
So how do they actually do that then? That process, do they sit with your food and watch it, do they? And then they start, how does that work?
So
do you know?
That's a really good question. And these are things I never knew as a consumer, as an eater.
Because there's two things, isn't there? There's the best before and then there's the sell-by.
Mm. So in the factory, they do what we call organoleptic testing, which basically means using your senses.
Yeah.
So they'll keep products out of every production run and they'll look at it every day and they'll smell it and, you know, stir it and see if anything untoward is happening. But then you also have, you can't rely on organoleptic testing because it's a bit sort of suck it and see. You have proper scientific lab tests done that measure yeasts and molds and bacteria. So you can tell exactly beyond this point, we're not going to say that it's good enough.
My dad told me once that when they started doing the Best Before Day, I think it was it Marks and Spencer's invented it or something. And then there was a guy my dad knew who worked in the Marks and Spencer's head office. And they used to, the way they did it was they'd sit with a packet of biscuits and they'd just keep eating them. And then one day they go, nah, they're on the turn here.
They're a bit soft.
And then
nobody died.
Whether that's true or not, my dad has told me a few tall stories. But if anyone from Marks and Spencer's is listening and they want to confirm that, that'd be great. And also I've got a product you can buy. It's called Moorish.
Actually, I'm sure M&S don't do that anymore.
You're probably, do you have to sign exclusivities then when you're...
So we did with Waitrose. We had to agree to a short exclusive period.
Okay, so you got to the... I interrupted you, went on a little journey there. But you sent the email to Waitrose. What happened?
Yes, so I sent an email to Waitrose and I remember it all really well. It said, so I'd only been going, you know, I'd had the idea... within a matter of weeks, but it was already in Planet Organic and Whole Foods and doing well enough that I had the confidence to approach Waitrose. And I just said, I've invented a new kind of hummus. Would you be interested? So I kept it that vague. I didn't say it was smoked hummus or anything else. And they wrote back the next day, which I now know is that the whole thing is highly unusual. But they wrote back the next day, must have been, you know, right thing at the right time. And they said, hi, Julie, can you come in and bring your hummus? Oh, my goodness. You know, that kind of email makes you stop in your tracks and go, wow, this again is getting very exciting. So I did. And I went in. And I think they liked the fact that I worked on the food program and I was doing the food and farming awards. And there were lots of, you know, well-known chefs. And I never got to meet the well-known chefs, but it, you know, gave me sort of credentials. But really, it's about the product. So they wouldn't taste it in front of me. They took it away and it was all blank faces. And I remember coming away thinking it's like an exam. You could have absolutely flown. You could have massively failed. You just have no idea. And in my naivete, I remember saying, would you like to know the price? And they were like, nope. That's a discussion we might have later. And I'm like, right, okay. And then nothing for 2 weeks. And it was summer holidays. I was in the play park with my little kids and the phone rang. And I could see it was Waitrose. I was like, kids, just stay on the swings for a minute. And mummy has to take a call. And it was this lady saying, you know, I don't know what your expectations are. I think I brought in 3 or 4 different flavours. But we'd like to take 2 of your products and put them on a trial and see how they go. And so within 6 months of having had that idea to make for my little boy this crazy wok smoked chickpea thing, it was national on the shelves in Waitrose.
How many months?
6.
Wow.
I know.
Though it must be said again, anyone who's sitting there going, this is easy, I'm going to do this. You were also a mother for 2 children and working at the BBC all at the same time.
Yep.
It is a commitment to do this stuff and probably not a good idea just to jack your job in straight away.
Oh, no. I would not recommend that. No, I mean, I always, like I say, I always had a really good feeling about it. I think I have a reasonable feel for business and opportunity. I love opportunities and I love to find opportunities and bring them to fruition. And I just felt like this was really exciting. But I did not give up the day job until I knew it was working.
So how long's Moorish been in the shops for now, then?
So that was October 2012. So we're in year 6.
Wow.
Now, yeah.
And does it do well for you? I mean, has it exceeded your expectations, really?
I don't know if monetarily I knew what to expect.
Right, okay.
But certainly I make a decent living from it. I'm, you know...
How do you price it? I mean, how are you just sitting there with a load of chickpeas? How do you know how to price that when you're doing something different to it? How much is a normal pot?
Depends where you shop. So my stuff is £1.99 in Waitrose. Most own label hummus is about £1. You know, okay. It's a fairly cheap commoditized product when you go into mass production. So, you know, out of that £1, obviously everybody's got to make their slice, or out of that £1.99. So I spoke to people, I spoke to my mentor, I spoke to the factory, I looked at the retail price, I Googled, you know, retail margins. I had to learn it all, really.
Is there a bit of guesswork involved, though?
There was a bit of guesswork. I know when I priced it to Waitrose, I went in thinking, you know, I can't charge too much because they'll say there's not enough in it for them.
Yeah.
Or the retail price would be too high and no one would buy it because people won't buy it at any price. Actually, it used to be £2.49 when we first launched in Waitrose. And it was brilliant. It went in just before Christmas, so loads over Christmas. And I now know that's key trading time for hummus. Guess what happened in January? My 249 hummus did not shift at all.
People eat hummus at Christmas.
Oh, my goodness. Parties. Loads of it.
I suppose, yeah.
Yeah. It's sort of summer and Christmas are our key trading times. So, suddenly the 249 was not working in January. So I proactively rang the buyer at Waitrose and said, I think we need to look at reducing the price to you. I can't tell Waitrose what to price it at on the shelf. That's absolutely their decision. But luckily she followed suit. We brought the price to £1.99 and since then it's been great.
It's been doing well. Yeah, they are absolutely delicious. I've got to say, I keep eating more and more of them.
They're Moorish, you see.
They are very, very Moorish. Yeah. So what happens with the... are you ever worried about the health aspect of it? I don't mean as in whether it's healthy or not, but you're making a product. I mean, I wouldn't know. When I watch Reggae Sauce, I always thought to myself, you might know this, you might not want to see the answer though. When that the actual product which turned up for Peter Jones to test, I imagine it's very different from a product which goes into a bottle, because they've got to at some stage make sure that stuff can survive on a shelf and be healthy. Mm. And if I was to make a sauce at home in my kitchen, it's only going to last 3 days, right? Before it starts going off and fermenting
right.
or whatever.
That's
right. So you have to get the scientist bods involved in it. When you're making it from your, sending it to deli,
yep.
Did you have to, how do you know about all these things to make sure it's got a long shelf life?
So because I was always making it from the moment I started selling it as a commercial venture, it was being done in the factory and they put me onto the lab testing. So it was always done in the right way. So I was just basically following instructions. They would say, well, you have to have it shelf life tested. You have to send it to the lab. You know, you'll get these results. They'll tell you this. Then you tell the retailer that about the shelf life, and then it's all okay. So you just have to do what the industry experts tell you to do.
And when Waitrose came in, how were you able to scale up quickly?
Yes. So I did offer the business to the factory in Birmingham. They couldn't handle that volume because suddenly it was going.
How exciting!
But
that poor factory as well. They must have been going, how can we do this?
I know. I think they did consider it. And right. I am a massive believer in sort of business karma. Yes, we're all out to make money, but I think there's a lot to be said about integrity. And, you know, I felt like I should offer it to them because they had let me come in and make the product. And if it wasn't for them, blah, blah, blah. But that, you know, it's interesting. It pays off again and again. Whenever I've been in a quandary about something and I've done the right thing, it always sort of comes back in benefit. It's just one of those things. But I offered it to them. They couldn't do it. So I found a factory in London, which is where I've been ever since.
Right.
So there are only a very small number of hummus expertise making factories in the UK. I kind of thought there might be a few hundred. I don't know.
Yeah, well, the figures you were giving earlier about how much we eat of this stuff. What sort of industry is it? You say how many billions? How many over here? How many? What do people?
Well, the chilled dip industry. I was looking recently for a presentation. The chilled dip industry as a whole. So if you widen it beyond hummus into your guacamole and salsa and tzatziki, it's 165 million. The industry is worth in the UK. It's huge.
It is huge. Who wins that battle? Not, I mean, company. I mean, what dip wins?
Hummus.
Is it hummus?
Hummus is the king.
Yeah. Why did we fall in love with it? Are there any health benefits to it? Tell us why I should be eating it.
Oh, well, it's got good fat. So it's got rapeseed oil, which has your omegas. So, you know, like oily fish, it has the fat that provides good things, not bad.
Wet nose and a bushy tail.
Hydrogenized fat.
Hmm? Yeah, wet nose and a bushy tail.
Exactly. Sharp brain, all of those things. It has chickpeas, which are high in fiber. It's a good source of protein. So vegetarians and vegans tend to eat a lot of hummus. And actually, they have commented that because it has a slightly bacon-esque taste because of the smoky notes, I always reassure them there's no smoked bacon or mackerel. But I think it sort of is reminiscent for people that maybe used to eat that kind of product. When they go vegan or vegetarian, there's a bit of that in it. But it's all about a combination of healthy ingredients. So back to your question about kitchen products versus, you know, manufactured products. This product is identical to what I made in my kitchen because hummus is so simple.
You haven't changed it at all?
Nope. It has such a small number of ingredients. And they are the same ingredients that you make in the manufactured hummus is just done on a much bigger scale. And that's not always the case. So you often find if you invented a recipe in your kitchen and took it to a factory, it would have to change quite a lot. But for this product, it just didn't. Yeah. It's still garlic, tahini, lemon, oil, chickpeas, water, smoked chickpeas, and that's it.
And do you have to do random taste tests every now and then, things like that, to make sure the quality of the products?
I buy the product, yep.
Do you?
Yep, yep, yep. So I sell it to my little tiny village shop, Stoke Gabriel Stores, hello, in Devon. And they laugh because I sell it to them, and then on a Friday night, I'll go back in and buy it again. But yeah, I like to, obviously, we still eat it, not sick of it after 6 years, but I like to make sure that it is always as it should be. But you know, that's what a factory's for, consistency. That's what they're good at. I could have set up my own production unit and, you know, gone about it that way. I am not an expert on food manufacturing. So it's about knowing what I'm good at and what I'm not, and then getting the bits of the business to be brought into the places where I'm not an expert.
Does it have to be kept chilled?
Yes.
So that's an added expense for Waitrose.
It's called the chill chain. So from the minute it's made until it sits in Waitrose, it goes through a process called the chill chain, and it's expensive for everybody. So it's expensive in the factory because it has to be kept chilled once it's made. So the storage is chilled, then chilled transport, which I pay for. So that's more expensive than just sending it, you know, on a normal lorry. It has to be in a temperature controlled vehicle, and then in a temperature-controlled warehouse for Waitrose, and then onto the fridge.
Did you do this all yourself at Digicharm Eating Carrot now? With your,
Stop eating!
I really like the one with the chilli, and that's really getting me.
Thank you.
It's really, you've got the chilli just right, lovely warmth.
Thanks.
Did you have to get money in from people? Did you have to go for VCs, venture capitalists?
No.
So you've done it all yourself?
Yeah, with nothing. And that's kind of one of the reasons why I wanted to come onto your podcast and talk about if you have a great product or a service, starting a business is doable. I did it, what we call bootstrapping. So every time I made money from the product, then I bought the next set of ingredients or the next labels, and I've grown it all without taking on any investors or anything like that.
Have you exported?
Yes, so it sells to Hong Kong.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Have you had to go over there?
No,
you've got to go
Hong Kong.
You've got to go for big business meetings in Hong Kong.
I should fly club class with British Airways, eat the product on the flight, and then go and buy it in Hong Kong.
Do they give you free flights now?
No, sadly not. No.
Hong Kong, are you going to be working to other markets, go to America and other places?
America would be interesting. So hummus in America is obviously massive, and they do all sorts of crazy stuff. So banana hummus, peanut butter hummus,
really?
Chocolate hummus. Yeah.
Wow.
And a bit of that is coming over here. There is the odd chocolate hummus.
Will you do that? Diversify into those sort of things? Why not?
Do you know what? I did make chocolate hummus for this little boy of mine who's now 10. He's not 4 anymore. And he blinking loved it. He absolutely loved it.
Yeah, I imagine everyone would.
It's really nice. But everyone, I don't know. There's the consumer message about what is chocolate hummus.
Yeah.
What I don't want is something sitting on the shelf with people just looking at it confused.
Yeah.
We'd have to do a lot of work, and it would cost a lot to get the messaging on pack right so that people would know. Would it sit in the hummus shelf? Probably not. It would probably go in dairy or dessert in that category. And then, you know, I'd love to do it. It would be super cool, but it's not easy. If you go too quirky, we're still a fairly conservative with a small C nation of eaters in some ways in mainstream retail.
So you're going to try and sell to other places? You're going to try and sell hummus back to North Africa?
Yes, yes. It would be, you know, a bit more export. It would probably be a really good way for us to grow. Mm-hmm.
What about in that when you get to somewhere like Waitrose, do you always hear about getting prime place on the shelves? Mm. Because they loved your product, did they give you...
So it was to do with the way the shelves work, the top tier products, so the most expensive products are at the top.
Oh, I like this.
And then the lower level products are the everyday or the own label.
Is that how it works?
Yeah. And then there's the sweet spot of your eye line. So, you know, retail experts analyze this to the nth degree as to where your eyes, they track people's eyes as they go around the store and put the products with the most profit margin at that eye level. It's all done in a really professional way where they know what they're doing. So my products tend to be either at the top or just a little bit lower down?
What you want to do is you want to go to a supermarket. This is people advice for people out there. One of my stupid ideas is you go to supermarkets and you look where there's a brand of something, but there's not many of them, only one or two of something. That's the marketplace. When there's loads of it, then you're going to struggle with it. So, but you've done well with yours, haven't you? I mean, how many different sites? So there must be quite a few people making hummus out there.
There's a lot of startup brands. So since I started,
oh, really?
the world of startup food and drink has just gone bananas. There's loads of startups of every kind of food, chocolate and smoothies and cereal bars and sauces. Everybody who has an idea is trying to get into this marketplace.
And are the supermarkets open? They must be open to it now, aren't they? Because years ago, they didn't want that. Really? They wanted to own everything, didn't they? And then the big brands like Heinz or something, they didn't want any competitors.
Yeah.
And then we were talking about this with Tom Kerridge the other day on the podcast. Is cheese. Did you speak to horrible big blocks of cheddar? That's all we could get. Mm. And then suddenly everyone wanted artisan cheeses and artisan projects and all that sort of stuff. And now the supermarkets have bought into the fact we want variety. And
exactly. And we want choices.
So I imagine, do they have to tell the big brands now, no, we're going to put other products in our shops? I suppose they have to.
It depends. So in some categories like hummus, it's predominantly own label. So it's me trying to convince an own label supermarket that my products won't. So it's called incremental sales. So if you put Moorish in alongside your Waitrose hummus, then you still sell the same amount of Waitrose hummus. You just sell more hummus because people will buy their normal hummus and they will buy this other hummus for a special occasion or a dinner party or drinks with the girls or for their kids. You know, it's all about showing that you're not going to cannibalize their business. You'll actually add.
Did they think about you making it for them?
One supermarket did ask and I said no, because I think it's a quite a special concept. And I felt that as a branded offering, it worked better.
What's going to happen when someone else comes along with smoked hummus? Are you going to be...
Well, guess what launched last year in Tesco, their own label smoked hummus.
Oh, really?
I always knew it would happen. And I'm actually really glad that it took a long time for it to happen. It's I don't know if I'm allowed to say this. It's not as good. And I hoped that would be the case. They have to make it cheaper. And I hoped it would be cheaper and worse. And it is. It's all right. If you'd never had mine, you might think it's all right.
Do they smoke the chickpeas or do they add a flavouring?
No, because that's me doing it my way, which I think is the proper way, is expensive. So they do it a different way.
So they just add flavouring?
They add a different smoked ingredient.
Oh, so they don't even smoke the chickpea.
They don't even smoke the chickpea. And it's all right. But, you know, it's kind of flattering for me that they've done it. As long as it's, you know, mine has to always be the best. Oh. That's the idea.
Imitation's a form of flattery, isn't it? You know, there was none before you came along. How do you go about the stuff I really like? When you've decided on the name, which you've decided on, how do you go about the marketing of it? The graphics and the font and everything else. How do you go about doing that?
Well, it's really interesting. That's new packaging that launched about a month ago with new branding. The whole look is completely different. So if you'd been shopping for it in February, the packaging looked totally different. The logo was different. The style was different. The colours were different. It was still black, but it was completely different. So it was still black and it was called Moorish, but it looked totally, totally different. And I'd taken advice from somebody who knows about these things and they said, your product is great, your packaging could be better. And it was time for me to then invest what, for my business, is a lot of money in going to a proper design agency who know about packaging and food packaging. And we put it out to tender and we spoke to three or four different agencies and we went with one and they've come up with this and it has made a huge difference to our sales.
Were you upset that someone criticised what you'd already had out there?
You kind of have to not be too precious. So if somebody eats it and says they don't like it, that's a bit hurtful. But, you know, I know everybody has their own taste and not everybody likes everything. Most people like it. Most people love it. So that's great. But I've learned not to be too precious.
Someone in that Tours of Titan book says, never ask whether people like the product, because they'll always say yes. Say, what would you change about the product?
Is
a better question, and then they'll start critiquing it. And said most of the criticism is nonsense because people don't know what they're talking about. But every now and then, someone will say something that you can use.
Yeah,
I heard that Red Bull I don't know how true this is, but Red Bull, when the guy did the testing on the flavours of Red Bull, everyone said it's terrible, it will never sell.
It's a very odd flavour.
But he was so determined to keep that flavour that he went with it, and now it's become very successful, as you know.
And he was right. Yep.
I also heard he liked buying into the idea of the fact that it was dangerous. You know the idea, you know the myth that if you have vodka Red Bull, it's going to send you do that. I don't know how true this is as well. I make up a lot of stuff, and I've been told a lot. I read a lot on the internet, but the company never wanted to go no and deny it because they liked being dangerous, and that's why they got into all their sports
fast
and dangerous
cars.
And that's how they decided to sell the product on being that sort of thing where it's quite a sugary, sickly drink, isn't it, really?
Keeps you awake at night.
Yeah,
yes.
keeps you going. What about the marketing for you? What do you do?
So we do... One of the reasons that there are a lot of food and drink companies coming through is that social media helps any sort of small business suddenly, whereas we couldn't afford necessarily a TV advertising budget, we can reach out to people on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. So we do quite a lot of that. We do competitions. So we link up with people like Martha from Bake Off. She was one of the contestants on Bake Off and she really likes the products. We sent her in some hummus. She said she'd run a competition and then we can, you know, reach people through her massive social media network where they hear about the product from somebody they trust like her. But she'll only do that, obviously, if she really likes the product. But that kind of endorsement really helps. So this is sort of the modern way of reaching people without your multi-million TV advertising budget.
Do you sell online?
No, because it's chilled. So for me to send you pot if you ordered from me online, Moorish online, so it always has to go through retail.
I went to a thing, a sustainability talk the other day from Nike. Really interesting, actually, how their whole marketing spend now. Actually, every product has to go through sustainability tests now. Mm-hmm. Are you ever aware of your carbon footprint when you're doing this? It must be pretty small, isn't it?
It's pretty small, and we tend to slipstream into... it's very boring supply chain talk.
No, I like it.
Chain talk?
Because I like the detail because you get all these products you see and you have no idea how they got there. And then when you hear a story like yours, you're like, wow, this can actually happen where someone can just have an idea and get it on the shelf. So it's interesting.
Does it happen?
Well, especially when you... I like the things I'm taking away from this is the idea that it goes chilled right from, and then has to stay chilled all its life. And the expense in that, that's what I'm seeing. Anyway.
Yeah, well, this slipstream that I'm talking about, if you do like boring supply chain detail, basically the factory are already supplying hummus under their own label or own label, so they make own label for some big customers, and they will have the vans already going from the factory to that retailer, and so we just put our stuff on the same van, and that keeps the footprint down, that kind of thing.
Okay. Will you be diversifying into more products, or do you think you've got it now and you've got it sorted, or will you keep
Always, you've got to run to stand still. So if I just sort of stepped back and went and lived in the Caribbean and let it run on the shelf, it's not going to work because there's new people coming in all the time trying to get my space on the shelf. And you have to keep innovating and keep fresh and keep bringing people what they want. So we've got some new product development that we've been doing. So we've got more smoked hummus flavours, but there's a limit to how many flavours of smoked hummus you can do. So then we've gone for other kinds of hummus. I can't say too much, but I'll send you some when they're a bit further down the line.
What do you mean other sorts of things which aren't made of
other
chickpea?
Twists.
Does it have to be chickpea and tahini to be hummus?
Technically, it's hummus by tahini, which is the sort of the official name, which is chickpeas and tahini. But you can make people make fava bean hummus or cannellini bean hummus.
Right. Tahini is sesame seed.
Sesame seed into paste.
Yes.
Yeah. Very good. 10 out of 10.
I'll tell you what, I've been doing that cooking show now for 11 years. I've learned a few bits.
You know
and
your
bobs.
Tahini.
So, all right, okay. So, because Jamie Oliver was on the show the other day and he was saying pesto just means sauce, which I was really shocked by. And then he made a pesto out of all different sorts of ingredients.
Yeah, you can make nettle pesto.
And he was making it out of, I can't remember, almonds, I think. And it's absolutely delicious, but he had mint in there and he had...
No pine nuts and basil.
No. I always thought that's what it was. That was just that. That was the sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then he told us not to buy it out of a jar.
Okay.
And then he said, but I know my face is on a lot of the jars. Yeah. which did make me laugh. You talked about a 30-year anniversary earlier.
Yes.
30-year of what?
So this is the hummus coming to the mainstream in the UK. So it was Waitrose. According to my research, I was barely alive 30 years ago, but it was hummus coming to the mainstream retail market in the UK. So suddenly you could buy it as a product in a shop.
I love that idea. I wonder what people made of it. Someone told me once that when avocado pears came along, people didn't know what they were, so they were eating them for dessert with custard because they didn't really know what. Because it's because we said a pear, didn't it? So
yeah.
And certain things, I always joke with Simon on my show, I say, that was before, I said, do you remember when they invented kiwi fruit? And that came over because it's like these things just didn't exist to us, did they, beforehand? Mm. Britain was crap with food, wasn't it, 40 years ago?
Yeah, people were very scared of foreign food and, you know, all those connotations. I remember my granny wouldn't eat pasta because she just thought it was weird. You know, we've changed a lot. And as you say, the supermarkets realise we've got more eclectic tastes. We want more diverse products. We're much more adventurous now than we used to be. And that's a great thing.
Have you become obsessive about hummus? Do you know all the background of it all and the history worldwide and all that sort of stuff?
I'm obsessive about running my business. I know enough about the history that I can talk to you about it, but I don't lie in bed and read the history of hummus books at night. But I'd never stop thinking about the business.
Are you enjoying running a business?
Yes. Yeah. So I was saying on the way over here, you know, as an entrepreneur, it's all the buck stops with me. I have to sort of spin all the plates, try and understand all the different elements of the business, make things work to the best way possible. It's quite exhausting. It's very full on. But actually, I live in Devon. I can do a lot of stuff, thank goodness, for email and mobile phones. I can, you know, fit things around my family. My kids are still quite small. It's an amazing way to live your life, to make a product that you love, sell it somewhere where the people that buy it love it, and be able to live somewhere nice and eat nice food.
I always think the success of these things is it's real. So it was a real solution to a problem, and that you wanted to feed
boring
your son.
Hummus. Yeah.
Yeah. And you just went, well, let's try this and then let's smoke it. And I love that sort of thing. I think that's why it's been such a great success story for you. There must have been, are there any dark moments in the story? Or if I'm turning it into a movie, I need a bit of where it goes a bit wrong somewhere.
We need the Jeopardy. There have been dark moments. There was another brand that came into Waitrose, another sort of smallish competitor brand that came in. And that's always a worry. What if they sell more than us? Because we're not under contract. If it sells, it stays. And if it doesn't, then, you know, the supermarket is not a charity. But luckily we came through and we won in the end and it's all good. But, you know, it is a roller coaster. It absolutely is a roller coaster. Every day can have massive highs and massive lows.
There must be huge rivalry with all the products going into Waitrose. Yep. You don't think about it like that, do you?
I think variety is good. I think competition is good. I always say I love competition as long as I win. But I think, you know, competition is good because it broadens consumers' minds. People get to try lots of different things. But, you know, I do take your point about authenticity and doing something. You know, I did it for the right reason, to make something taste really nice. And I think those are the things that do tend to work. So if people just try and launch something to make a load of money, that's not going to cut it. It won't have the longevity. You've got to do things out of love.
Do you know what? It's the same on TV. Obviously, I've worked on magazine shows for 20 years. And when you try and manufacture an item of some description and try and get it to go viral or something, it never works. When it happens organically, people love it and they buy into it because they can see it happening in front of them. And it must be similar to a product. It's such a nicer thing to have that lovely accident of what you've had rather than you sitting there one day going, right, what shall I have? Custard, you know, I'll try and manufacture custard. Which, how's it going on the British Airways flights then? Do the customers love it?
Yeah, really good, really good. We get nice comments. I always tell people if they're going on a flight to look out for it. It's just quite a cool thing to say. When I see a British Airways plane going overhead, my husband took a photograph a few years ago of a Waitrose van and a British Airways plane flying above it going, you've hit the double jackpot.
Yeah, that's good. And cool. How do they manage to keep it all fresh then? So they've got, I suppose they've got to keep it refrigerated all the
same
way to the
same chill chain,
And then they've got to get it to the plane, they've got to keep it.
Then it's in the fridge on the plane. Yeah, just has to be...
Do you think you're going to write a book about your experience?
Yeah, I'd love to. I'd love to. I don't know whether or not to write a business book about how to start a food business, sort of my life story book. Don't know how interesting that would be. Or a recipe book, things to do with hummus. I don't know. I'd love to write a book, but I can't quite decide which one to write.
I ask everybody who comes on this show, this podcast, the same questions. Did I send them to you?
No, but luckily I listen to your podcast, so I know what to expect.
Wow, I just thought, I'm not sure I sent them to you. I want to ask you for some advice for people who want to set up businesses. Is that in your answers, do you think, you're going to be giving me those?
No, but I get asked that a lot, so we can do that.
Go on then.
Yeah. So make sure it is a brilliant product or service. That is the first thing. Whatever it is has to be really good. It's got to be different, better, or ideally both to what's already out there. Otherwise, what's the point? And it's about having a combination of the right thing and then a lot of tenacity. If you don't ask, you don't get. So don't be afraid to ask for what you want. And just believe in it. If you believe in it, then other people will too.
And you have to be bothered.
Oh, goodness, yes.
So good example.
Not just bothered, but obsessed.
Yeah, I suppose a good example of that is this podcast, really, because I'm not making any money, as you know. But I love it. Mm. And so if it does turn into a business, it's because I've done over 70 of these now, because I'm turning up and I love the product. I love what I'm doing and I'm meeting people like you and I'm really enjoying it. So I can be bothered to do it. If you ask me to start a custard company, oh God, I couldn't be bothered.
Good. <Yeah. laughs> You're not going to rival me on the
with
shelves.
With the custard, no. All right, so let's get into these questions then. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
I think it's about keeping the main thing the main thing. So whether it's in business or in your home life, whatever it is that is, you know, if you have young children, then that's your focus and that's okay. Some people think, you know, if they have children, well, I should be working and I should be doing this and doing that. Or in business, you try and diversify too quickly. Whatever is your main raison d'etre at that moment, just keep the main thing the main thing. Give all your focus and all your abilities and attention to that without worrying about other people. Comparison is the road to hell. Don't worry about, you know, I do have to try and block out other competitor products or, you know, the Joneses next door, what people are doing. I just think focus on yourself and what you're doing and do your very best and be aware of what else is happening or what other people are doing or have or say or whatever. But you've just got to stay true to yourself.
This isn't a sexist question because I've had to go through this whole dilemma myself a lot. How do you find balance? Work, family, career, family balance. I took a job once. It was such a mistake. And in my negotiations, I negotiated time and they couldn't believe it. I was going, give me less money, but more time because I knew it was getting me away from my children. I hated it.
Yeah.
It didn't last long because of that. And I realized I'd made a mistake. And then after the back of it, I said to everyone, I'm never working on Sunday again. I've worked for the last 11 years every Sunday, but I now don't work Saturday. So was at one stage, I was doing Saturday, Sunday on Soccer M and Sunday Brunch. It's like, I have no time with my kids at the weekend. No. This is ridiculous. How do you balance that side of things?
So it's not easy and you have to be mindful. And obviously I'm working to provide for the kids. So I can't not worry about work because if I didn't work and spent all the time with them, then how do we eat? But I think it's all about going with your gut. I know if I'm not spending enough time with him, I feel it. I'm aware of it. It hurts me. And I have to put the brakes on, even just for a week, a day, an hour, and just go, right, that's it. I'm going to do this now. But what I have learned to do is to be uber productive. So the minute they go to school until the minute they come home, I can achieve what you know, I used to achieve in corporate life in a full day. I can achieve between 9:30 and 2:30. The most amazing, you know, we've got one of my colleagues here. He'll know that, you know, I start emailing at 6 in the morning because that's when I wake up. I'm a morning person. I might email late in the evening, but that window between 9:30 and 2:30, bam, 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 bam. I know what I've got to do. I haven't got the luxury of spreading out over a whole day. And actually, it really works. I'm so focused in that time. Then when they come home, I can be with them and make the tea. And, you know, I do go to London and I stay away, but I combine the meetings all into one or two days. So I'm never away for long. It's just all about thinking it through to make it work. Otherwise, what's the point of being self-employed and not seeing my kids? It's got to work on both levels.
Did your partner qualify?
Yes, he's an osteopath now.
He's an osteopath.
Yeah, very handy when I have aches and pains.
It's. I was saying at the top of that question, it's not sexist, but if you read Harriet Harman's book, it's amazing. If I did decide to just not see my children, no one would really care that much. Mm. I'm a man, and they go, oh, he's busy, he's got a supply. Women who decide to work, Harriet Harman's book is amazing. I really recommend everyone read that because she was trying to compete in a man's world of politics where everyone's going, you're a woman, you can't do it, and you've got children, so you can't do it. So she had to work particularly hard to prove that she was able to do the job. And the guilt she had to feel, she talks about in the book, between being a mum and also working as a politician. Hopefully women don't have to go through that as much now, but what she had to go through was phenomenal. It's really, really great read. Really great read.
And it should not be the case. It shouldn't be that women have to be so torn. And I'm in a very male-dominated industry. Manufacturing is largely middle-aged blokes. Yeah, massively, massively.
What do they make of you then?
I think they think that I'm a pain in the neck. I'm very demanding,
Why?
Apparently.
Oh, yeah?
Yep. Yeah, well, you know, it's got to be done. It doesn't matter if I'm a man or a woman. They might take it a bit more easily from a man. But if something has to be done, it has to be done, and I'll nag on until it's done.
Do you ever get that now listen love stuff from people, or is that gone now?
I think they do look a bit baffled in meetings sometimes, thinking, who is she?
Yeah.
You know, what is she doing here? But hey,
I think we need a thought process shift change in the society where people value the family a lot, and we look on employers who are making their staff work ridiculous hours, because there are people who still have to put in a lot of hours and to supply for their children and don't get a chance to see their children. Mm. But I think we need to put the emphasis on the employers who are doing this stuff to say, well, hold on, that's not fair. Mm. The children need the parent needs the children. We need to prioritise family life a bit, I think.
We need to look after people, but actually...
And that's everywhere. I mean, from the top end where they're earning the billions down to the bottom end where minimum wage, employers need to help people look after their families
more.
And I talked to that about with Harriet Harman. You know, I think politicians very much want to prioritise work all the time. And I think families are really important and children need their...
You only get one shot at being a parent, don't you? You know, mine are now 13 and 10. And, you know, you look back and think, where's it gone? They're not little anymore. But I think it's all about, for me, it's about productivity. I don't actually care what time of day an employee starts work and what time they finish. This is the task. And if you get it done in half an hour, then... You know, you can work half an hour a day. If you want to work from 6 till 12 or 8 till 4 or whatever, surely it's about the output, not about sitting there clocking in, clocking out, because that's what you have to do. Yeah. I didn't get flexibility when I was an employee. And that's why this lifestyle is really important to me, because I think even though I worked in university with alleged flexible working policies, it's rubbish. Mm. It doesn't work. It's not, you know, people aren't looking after people with families.
Families, yeah.
And I would never have got... I didn't have a straight, linear career. I would never have sat on the board of a company if I'd you know, just gone back to traditional life. So I always say I had to make my own board and put myself on it. That was the way for me as a woman with children who focuses on her children to get onto a board was to make my own.
I'm conscious I might have sounded vulgar earlier by saying I gave up a job, but, you know, I do... I'm trying to do the balance the same as everyone else. I've just got a weird job in media where I've got strange hours and I could afford to do that. So apologies if it did sound vulgar. What mistake do people make maybe doing your job?
What, in life?
Yeah.
I think the whole it's not a dress rehearsal thing. People lose track of the fact that, you know, work isn't everything.
Have you heard the Paul McGee 7 days a week thing?
Yeah, I listened to your podcast.
It's brilliant, that.
Yeah.
I'm on Saturday. Oh, I've only got Sunday left and bank holiday Monday if I'm lucky. And if I'm really lucky, bank holiday Tuesday. Mm. Yeah.
That's a horrible thought, isn't it?
I liked it.
Did you?
I liked it.
Did it
because
give you a kick?
It just changed. It really, it's one of the few, well, not one of the few. I've had so many things in this podcast that I've enjoyed listening to. But one of the things which had huge impact on me, because now I just look at it like, all right, I've got to this stage in my life now. I'm not getting another life, as
this
you say.
It. This is it.
So I'm very careful about what I do, and I only do stuff that I really want to do now.
Exactly.
So I'm very conscious of all that. So I think that's quite good. I added another question in after Tom Kerridge, so I'm going to do it now. What's the biggest mistake you've made? Have you got one of those? Sorry to spring this on you. Is there one you've made? Because he opened up a restaurant that bombed because he had the... I don't think it bombed. He just had the wrong partners who didn't have the same mentality as him. That's what he said. If you don't worry, because I've sprung this on you.
Well, I think putting myself out there as a live newsreader was not the thing that I'm most suited to. I understand myself a bit better now. So I like talking. This is really fun for me. This is better than sitting in the office sending emails. But live news reading is absolutely terrifying. And if something goes wrong, it's you in a studio with the script. And if there's a technical hitch, what have you, I was not the right person to deal with that. That just absolutely sent me into a massive spin. I hated it. And I think it's about learning what you think you might like is not necessarily what you're actually good at and should do.
I think with news, it's really interesting because I love it when things go wrong on my TV show.
Man.
I love it. And I was working at Five Live when I was just doing a football call-in show, 606, and a huge incident happened. And I had to keep throwing to journalists all over the world and whatever, and in other parts of the world. And I loved it. I loved the pressure of all that sort of stuff.
You like the winging it?
Yeah, I like it because that's what I've got some modicum of skill at being able to listen in my ear and talk. Because I've been doing it for so long, really. Anyone could do it if they've been doing it as long as I've been doing it. But I would struggle with the news just because the pronunciation of all the words and also the tone you have to hit all the time, that serious tone. I would struggle around it.
But then you'd have your nice piece at the end where you'd break into a smile.
And
yes.
Finally. Well, yeah, I had ad-lib all around my auto-cue and I don't think they would like that. Any life hacks?
Life hacks. I have a lot of cooking hacks.
Oh, go on. Give us one
that
of those.
I do. So, right, don't tell anyone, but when I make a lasagna, I buy grated cheese. But you know, life is too short to stuff a mushroom. Life is too short to grate cheese. So I will buy ordinary cheese.
That's ridiculous.
I will buy ordinary cheese when we need ordinary cheese. But you know what? If you're making a cheese sauce, buy the grated cheese.
Why?
Because saves me time.
Yeah, but does it save money? Oh, yeah, saving time's good. Does it save money? I don't know the difference in pricing.
It is a bit more expensive. Of course it is.
Is it?
Yeah, because it's been done for you.
And how does it last, grated cheese? Because if I grate it at home and then leave it, it's going to go orangey colour.
Yeah, but it's in the sealed packet. It's fine.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
I think it's not so much about the grated cheese. It's about finding... if there's an easy thing that you can do...
No, I'm focusing on grated cheese.
If you can make your life easier, you know what? Just do it.
Yeah, that's a good one. Are you conscious of all prices in supermarkets now?
Yeah.
If I give you a product, could you possibly tell me how much it was?
Oh, no, it is like being a politician.
Oh, yeah, they always do that.
Yeah.
How much is
a pint of milk?
How much is a pint of milk? I don't know, actually. You know, people don't buy it, do they?
Pints.
They
buy it in those, the big 2-litre thing.
Yeah, I kind of know things like chicken and stuff because I'm always looking at that. I don't know what a pot of something would cost, really.
Well, I know now if it's a big brand or a little brand and sort of what the margins will be and what the advertising budget will be and if it's on price promotion, how that's being funded. Yeah, so I have a bit of insight that I didn't used to have when I see it.
Do you think, I was in Marks and Spencer's the other day. Sorry about that. Your competitors. They do lovely fruit though there. And I was in the vegetable department and I noticed cauliflowers, £1. Broccoli, £1. I thought, I wonder if the pound shop has had an influence on the fact that they just make everything £1 and we think, well, buy it, it's £1. And pounds just become an irrelevant thing, really, because of all those pound shops. Am I overthinking this?
No, you're right. The pound shop has had a massive influence. And also you'll find some supermarkets only sell products at round numbers. So Sainsbury's hummus would be £2, whereas in Waiters it would be £1.99.
Right, so why? Why? Because I always thought they always made out the £1.99 is because you think it's under £2 and it's £1. But do we like the round numbers now?
Well, some do and some don't. They have different sort of pricing strategies, different supermarkets.
Well, it worked for me because I bought both a cauliflower and a broccoli because I thought...
But not from the pound shop.
I just thought, they're a pound, I'll buy one each. £1 there and £1 there. Mm,
it's making it easy. You know, there's all this stuff about, well, in this supermarket, it's priced per kilo. Uh-huh. And then in this supermarket, it's priced per pot. And in this supermarket, we're supposed to be as responsible suppliers, making it easy for shoppers to understand. There's the whole Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall fat fight and the traffic light labelling that he's getting really upset about because it's not clear to shoppers how much sugar is in your breakfast cereal or, you know, how much salt is in a product. As responsible food suppliers, we should be making things really clear for people so they know what they're buying.
Is it clear on yours, what you're buying? Yeah.
We break it down so you can see the nutritional value per pot and then per serving. And we've taken feedback from shoppers saying that's what they want to see, and that's a new addition to the detail on the back. So you're not going to eat a whole pot in one go, but you might eat one serving. So then you know I've had that many calories.
Yeah, you've got lots of proper ingredients that I've heard of, which is good.
Good.
all the ingredients. I've heard of all the ingredients in your stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, that's a start, isn't it, when you can do that?
That's what you want. So it's real food.
Yeah. If you start reading stuff. Because I say that to Simon all the time. He says, what's your diet? And I say, I just eat food and nothing else. And he says, what does that mean? I said, well, I don't eat anything which I don't think looks like food. Mm. So I mean, he's taught me a lot of this. Like, I don't eat a lot of the stuff which comes packaged up already or anything like that. Because I just
don't know what's in it.
I just don't think it looks like, it is food but I just think it's best just to stick to stuff that I know.
Yes.
What is the meaning of life?
So my son says I'm very hippie-ish. I think the meaning of life is love.
Love. Oh, yeah. Don't get started on that because yeah. I have no idea what love is. Can you define love?
I think you have to
good
look
luck
to,
with that.
Look to yourself. So I'm reading a book that I would recommend to
all right.
Tim.
That was one of my questions. So go on, what's
your
book?
It's called The Return to Love by Marianne Williamson. And it's all about how we've all lost sight of, we're in a brightly lit room with our eyes closed going, it's dark in here. We've lost sight of what we really are, what we're really here for. It's all about love and it's about understanding the love within yourself and then loving other people and seeing the good in them. And I don't think you would know what love is in loving another person until you know what the love is in yourself. We're getting very hippie-ish now.
See, I agree with all that, but I'm working on a new theory that because I like working on my theories, that life's about stories because we're the only animal on the planet that can tell a story. And it seems that our stories, which maybe include love, is what we're doing best. And that is, we tell stories to ourselves. I've not thought this through very much. I've talked to Mark a bit about this, but we'd spend all day long telling ourselves stories. Mm-hmm. And then we tell everybody else stories. Mm-hmm. And then we'll go on holiday and we'll tell the story about what we did on holiday to tell them a story, to influence that. And life seems to be, cats can't, I'm looking at my cat there, that can't, she can't tell a story.
Mm, it's a human trait. But yeah, I think your self-stories can be quite dangerous. You can give yourself a script.
Yeah,
you can tell yourself stories about, I am like this, I am like that.
Yeah, 100%. That's
not good sometimes.
Especially at 3 o'clock in the morning last night when I was doing
when you're on the Saturday of your life, Tim.
But that's, do you know, that's the one thing, anything you think of at night is nonsense. It's dark, horrible, it's the worst. The world's gonna end. I think we've done all our questions. Thank you so much for coming on show. Where can people follow you if they want to?
So if you look on social media for Moorish Hummus, we're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
Okay, and if they want to buy your products, I've got a list here.
Waitrose, Ocado, Whole Foods.
Okay,
and
brilliant.
Farm shops and delis.
And business class flights on British Airways.
Right, if you're lucky enough to fly business class.
That's fantastic. It's absolutely delicious. Fina, thumbs up for the food. Yeah, she loves it as well. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, let's keep in touch and see what happens. That was Julie. I enjoyed her story. Did you?
Yes.
Crunching carrots and celery all the way through it. It sort of inspires you, doesn't it? It makes you want to go and set up a business. I think we should do more of those. What do you think?
I think we should because it's... it's something that everyone can really identify with. She's got the story, she's, you know, she's got her own kids, and the reason why she made it happen, I think it's quite encouraging that.
And the fact that she's managed to get herself into a big supermarket chain is great,
it's
isn't
awesome,
it?
Yeah.
If you've got any ideas of anyone we should interview about the great business, Fina. If you've got any, that's her chilling away. If you've got any ideas of anyone, or if you'd like to, if you yourself have set up a great business and you think you'd make a good podcast, let us know.
It's a carrot talking.
Which was your favourite? I wanted to.
I know. Okay, I was thinking about this. I am either the chilli one.
The chilli's got such a lovely warmth.
Yeah, it's lovely warmth.
I think it's the chilli one. She's got the spice just
but
right.
But the baba ganoush ain't bad with the flatbread too.
Quite like the original.
But the classic
as well.
One too. Yeah. I know.
That is good. Yeah, it's very good. All right, well, listen, that's it for this week's podcast. We'll be back very soon with another one. If you want to contact me, you can at Tim Lovejoy. You can email me at dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. You can subscribe to us. I've got some carrot caught in my mouth. You can rate us 5 stars. We'll see you all soon. For the time being, peace and love, Joy.